you know about the USA? Do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution?
A little music from Schoolhouse Rock to get us going today as we talk civics education to begin the show. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. And Sam Shintaugh is with us in the studio. He's the creator and director of the Common Good Initiative. It's a program dedicated to civic education and strengthening bonds between citizens and government. Sam's also a lecturer at both UW-La Crosse and Viterbo University. And as we talk with Sam, we want to hear from you. Let us know your questions about civics, and that might include the Constitution, maybe how elections work, maybe the branches of government, and, of course, a whole lot more. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sam Shintaugh, welcome to the program, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's wonderful to be here down in Madison. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Civics education includes a lot of things.
Absolutely. So, you know, when people think about civics education, the first thing they go to is, of course, the nuts and bolts, right? How our government operates, the three branches, what's in the Constitution. And obviously, all of that is important. That's the fundamentals. That's the building blocks that we've got to start with. But I always like to think that civics education is so much more than this. It is learning the building blocks and then actually practicing with the building blocks, actually deliberating with each other, having those conversations about our government, about how government operates, about maybe what we're seeing in current events and applying it to the building blocks. And so when we started this program, we called it Rebuilding American Civics. The idea was to provide those building blocks. Fundamentally, I took my Intro to American Government class that I've taught for years, broke it down and said, okay, we can offer this for free to adults in the community as well. So let's make sure people have a place to learn, to get education. But more importantly, let's have a place where people can come together and have those conversations across the political spectrum, where people can actually sit down face to face and converse about these very matters.
So the topics you include?
We always start at the top, the founding, the Constitution, what's in the Constitution. But then we get into things like breaking down civil liberties, breaking down civil rights, talking about interest groups and their role in the government, talking about the Congress, talking about the president. So, again, kind of tracking what would be in a typical Intro to American Government class for folks, but then giving people those nuts and bolts chapter by chapter. But as we go, we give ourselves enough space to actually be able to have conversations about those things along the way. So as an example, this year, what we decided to do in the class is we're doing a slow read of the Constitution, a document I think everyone thinks they're very familiar with. But, you know, think about, when is the last time you actually sat down and read this thing and thought about what's in there? And so we just started right at the top. And every class, we just go as far as we can, working together, talking about the language, talking about what's in there, importantly, talking about what's not in there, and talking about how it might apply to our current times.
So is it a broad range of people who attend your classes?
It is. I would say it's mostly retired folks because we do them during the day at lunch hour. We've tried a bunch of – we've been doing this program now for about 6 years, and we've tried different times. We found our sweet spot at the noon hour. So I would say we mostly get retired folks, but we do some offshoot programs. So, for example, just last year we started a new program with the Rivoli Theater up in La Crosse called Civics and Cinema. And there we pick a famous movie that has some tie to civics issues. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, for example, was our first one. And there we bring the community in, we let people come in, we watch the movie together, and then we have a conversation. Well, with that, we're finding that we've got a very disparate age group. Just last week, we showed Dr. Strangelove as part of our Civics and Cinema. We had over 100 people there, and I would say easily half of the folks there were under 35, had never seen the movie before, were interested in talking about about some of the topics that were presented by the movie. So we are getting a great age demographic, and importantly, we're getting a wide political demographic. We're getting people across the spectrum who are simply interested in learning and having those conversations.
And this is not a course about politics per se.
No, you know, I always like to think that the politics and politicians, they're important in the moment, right? But all this stuff is ephemeral, or it's passing in our kind of bigger discourse on civics. What really matters in terms of understanding civics? Well, we have to understand the structure, the rules, the norms. And so we always start there, making sure that we have a common understanding of those things. And then we can apply what's happening in current events using our understanding of those structural pieces there. But no, we try, I mean, obviously...
Politicians come and go.
Politicians come and go. The Constitution stays the same. And I think it's really important that we kind of keep that in mind. So are we going to talk about political things? Of course. But the beauty of this, too, is once you start understanding the structure, the conversations you have about politics tend to be much deeper, much less intensive, right? So people actually kind of take the temperature down because we're actually working from a collective body of understanding, which is quite nice. And you know, it's that old line. I always like to tell my college students, who I also, you know, teach this with the university students, to say, you know, you hear growing up, well, you don't talk about politics and religion in mixed company, right? But the problem is, in living in a democratic republic like we do, we have to talk about politics. The problem is we don't do it well. And so what we're trying to do is provide some context for people to have better, deeper conversations about what they're seeing out in that political world.
You get pretty good feedback?
We do, yeah. We get both great participation and great feedback in terms of what people are learning. I have several folks that are, you know, just I'll see them out in town and they'll say, oh, there's my professor. It's great to see my professor there. I'm learning all this stuff. But it's the feedback is also, you know, what do you want to learn about, or what are you interested in terms of the structure? What maybe do you feel there are misperceptions or misunderstandings about that we can really dig into? So it's been a great program. We started back during the pandemic, so many things did. We started online. We had a handful of people that started initially, and now we get anywhere from 50 to 80 people sometimes for some of our programs, just showing up regularly. And every session we do this, I'm just really happy to report, we get a few more people. So people are still finding it and coming out every time.
Sam Shinta, our guest, he is creator and director of the Common Good Initiative, a program dedicated to civic education. I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts as we move along today. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. You know, thinking about the Constitution, one of my favorite things in the Constitution is the preamble. I love, you know, and I can't give it to you right now, but we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Am I getting
Yep. You're there. Yep.
Provide for the common defense.
Yep.
Promote the general welfare.
Yep.
And secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves.
And
our posterity.
And right there, Larry, you hit the key language of this preamble. So for years, I mean, I love the preamble. It is beautiful. And there's so much, if you break that down, that's packed in there. For so long, I focused on the we the people part, because obviously there you get this whole idea of self-government, of this whole idea that this government comes from the people. It doesn't say we the politicians in Washington. No. It says we the people. But then we list all these wonderful things that are being protected, being created by this Constitution. But then when we get to that last part there, establish justice for ourselves and our posterity. And this whole idea of stewardship that is embedded in this, this notion that all of these gifts that our Constitution give us are for us, making sure that we are providing them also for our neighbors, but our posterity as well. Everybody that comes after us deserves the same government. And so our jobs as citizens, in part, is to make sure we're tending this well, that we are good stewards of government so that everybody who comes after us can enjoy it as well.
I learned that back at Madison East High School.
Well, it's you had it perfectly. That was you were great. You were right on target with that.
Although I think I would occasionally miss and say prosperity instead of prosperity.
Well, and it's funny, when I come to that posterity word, most people don't know what that means in this or think about what that means. And when people learn about this, think about it, all of a sudden it's, oh my gosh, that's, you're right. We are good stewards of this government. We have to make sure our children, our grandchildren also get to enjoy the gifts that have been given to us from prior generations.
Yeah. Rich in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rich. Rich, are you there?
Yeah. Hi, good morning. It's been a long, long time since I had Mr. Wiebe's freshman American government class at Madison West High School. He taught something vitally important in that class, and that was the importance of the three branches of our government. But I want to hone in more specifically, if you don't mind, please, about the judicial branch. I have some real concerns about how partisan it's becoming. I'd like a little bit of a refresher and maybe some clarity around the whole idea or the concept of these three branches being somewhat independent and operating as checks and balances on one another. And I was just wondering if your guest would be willing to share something about his thoughts on the judicial branch becoming so partisan, please.
You bet. Well, Rich, thank you so much for the question. First of all, to your first part, one of the things I hear in terms of feedback from our students all the time is, hey, this is great. It's wonderful to actually be talking about civics for the first time since high school again. So it's always wonderful to engage with folks. So you're absolutely right about the checks and balances. If you read the Constitution, if you read the Federalist Papers, you understand that our government is in theory these co-equal branches that have some exclusive powers, some shared powers, and then some checking powers. This whole idea that they are there to kind of work together, but also to make sure that no one branch has too much power. And our judicial branch, as it kind of grew out of the Constitution and then through some important decisions, gets this checking power of making sure that whatever those other branches are doing conforms with the Constitution, conforms with the rule book. Now, the challenge is that when you look at the Constitution, one of the beauties is it is both very specific but also very vague in parts, which means that some folks are going to have different interpretations of what exactly some of the things that are listed in the Constitution actually mean, what the extent of those powers are, what the extent of authority is. And what I always like to point out to students is that, you know, if you look at the way that our Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution, you've got justifications for what we might call more of an originalist interpretation, mm-hmm. where you look at the text, you look at the intention at the time, and you've got some justification for a living Constitution interpretation, that the thing grows over time, which means that by that very nature, you're going to have legitimate arguments from both sides, right, looking at how to interpret this thing. What you hope at any given time is that the court is doing this in a way that they're acting like judges, meaning they're being as impartial as possible in terms of the politics, while also understanding that they are going to have some ideological differences in terms of how that interpretation might go. And I think what often happens is people conflate those things, right? That they see that the court is maybe interpreting the Constitution one way that seems favorable to one political side, and so therefore the court is necessarily being political, when in fact it might simply be being ideological and ideologically consistent, which simply just is also an adaptation or reflection of the politics. So I like to think for the most part that our federal judges try to do a very good job of being judges, but understanding that they're going to come at this thing with some different opinions in terms of interpreting the Constitution. And I think that's fair and legitimate.
Now, Albert emailed us, would like to hear about the decline in civics from the 50s to present. And also, what was behind the, who or what was behind the decline?
Yeah, I can't speak to what, why the decline. When I speak with folks all the time, I hear that we taught civics more centrally. It was stronger back in the 50s and the 60s. We fell away from that. I'm sure, like so many societal issues, there it's a multi-causal thing that, you know, how much did testing play into this? How much did the way that we just do education generally play into this? The nice thing is Wisconsin is one of the states that actually has a civics requirement in its high school, in its high schools. So all students have to take an American government class. And the really nice news is that they are bolstering that civics requirement because, as I, you know, going back to where I started this conversation, civics is more than just knowing the ABCs of the Constitution and the three branches. It's also being able to engage with people in civic critical thinking centric conversations. And so a lot of the new civics requirements are pointing in that direction of trying to not just get the knowledge, but actually having people practice being citizens. So I agree completely with Albert that we've fallen off a little bit over the past several decades. We see this reflected in polls. We maybe see it reflected in behaviors in society in terms of how people have these tough conversations. But the good news is I think as a state, we are moving in the right direction with respect to our secondary education on civics education.
Another emailer here. These days, talking about politics can be so emotional. How can you have a productive conversation with someone who you may not agree with?
Yeah, it's one of the hardest things we do, right? And it goes back to that line about we try to avoid it because we think, well, in polite society, you shouldn't do it. But we have to do it. And so what I always like to think is, well, first of all, again, if we can start with the shared stuff. Okay, let's read the Constitution together. Let's understand our founding principles. Let's understand what it means to be Americans. Let's find those places where we agree. And then we can work out from there. And that tends to diffuse some of the emotion. Not all of the emotion, but some of the emotion. Then taking some very simple things into account here. I was just talking with a friend of mine this morning. When we think about sharing opinions, at the end of the day, whose opinion do you get to control? Your own, yeah. Right? Whose opinions do you get to control? Your own? Everyone else's opinions, right? You have a persuasive ability, perhaps. But part of this is sometimes listening to other people to try and appreciate where they're coming from. Again, going back to talking about the Supreme Court justices, there are a multitude of ways to interpret the Constitution. Just because you favor one doesn't mean it's right. It means it's right for you. It means that that's where you feel strongly. But we also benefit sometimes from listening to somebody else and hearing their truth. That can maybe reinforce and bolster our truth, or it can give us some new information that we didn't have before. So part of the conversational part is that active listening. Now, again, does that diffuse all of the emotion? Absolutely not. But I think some of these simple things that we could do might help to diffuse some of it, at least.
Yeah. Are there some common misperceptions about the Constitution, or is that kind of what you were just telling me?
So some things that folks are surprised by. So, for example, the First Amendment, and I see politicians even do this. The First Amendment speaks to government control of speech. And so I always have to remind people that, you know, if a social media platform deplatforms somebody, takes them off, that's not a violation of the First Amendment. It might be a violation of our free speech principles, right, that we want to believe in a society of free speech, but only the government can infringe on your free speech and it be a First Amendment violation. So that's an eye-opener for some folks. The other one, we're talking about these co-equal branches. Well, if you were, say an alien landed on the planet here, right, and they could somehow understand English and understand our structure of government, and they read the Constitution, they would be convinced that this was a legislative form of government, that the Congress should be the most powerful part of our government. If you read the Constitution, it's got the most explicit powers. It's got the longest list in terms of what it can actually do. And yet, today, if you ask most people, is Congress the most powerful part of our government? I don't think you'd find many people agreeing with that statement, right? So sometimes it helps you to read this stuff and to understand the context to get a better sense of how this thing might operate effectively.
Judy in Fitchburg emailed us, have you ever invited Senator Russ Feingold to be a guest at his class? He's a walking constitution and carries a copy in his pocket.
Yes, I carry one with me all the time as well. It's a great rule book to always have. We have not reached out to him for this class. I have met Senator Feingold in the past. I know he was the head of the Constitution Center, I think it was, for a while. If he's listening, we would love to have him out in La Crosse to come talk about it. We welcome a lot of different public figures when they're available to come and talk with our class about how they see some of this stuff as well.
And Justin in Madison emailed, is there any possible way that we could shift to a multi-party system like they have in many other places in the world? Perhaps that could solve some of the deep issues we have in this country with only two parties in power.
Yeah, this is one, Justin, that I hear a lot about, that people are frustrated with the two-party system. They wish that we could break out of it. And without getting too political science nerdy on this, there are some structural things that in our government that kind of disallow or maybe make that very, very difficult for a third party to gain traction. But just on the bigger picture, these two parties dominate our political conversation. I had a friend back in Denver who always likened it to, when I lived there a long time ago, likened it to the Pepsi versus Coke, right? That you pick Pepsi versus Coke. Well, what if I like root beer? Well, you get Pepsi versus Coke. Well, what if I want 7-Up? What if I want, well, it's available, but, you know, Pepsi versus Coke at the end of the day, because that's your choice. And so those two parties really dominate and take up so much of the oxygen in our political sphere that that's also very difficult. Now, never say never. I think that there has definitely been enhanced interest over the past several years in looking at third parties and trying to get more space for those. And I know here in the state, for example, they're looking at things like Final Five voting that could certainly enhance opportunities potentially for third parties.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, on that note, Sam, boy, the time flew.
Absolutely.
I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I'd love
to do it.
I'd love to talk with you some more because we have plenty more to cover. Sam, thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. Have a great day.
Sam Shinta, our guest, creator and director of the Common Good Initiative. It's a program dedicated to civic education. He's also a lecturer at UW La Crosse and also at the Turbo University. It's great to have him with us, and we'll get him back and we'll do it again. We can all learn a little more about civics, for sure. Coming up, we're going to take a look at some legal issues relating to condos and HOAs. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking now about some legal issues relating to condos and homeowners associations, or HOAs as they're typically called. Our guest, John Scott, with us today. He's an attorney. He's based in Brookfield, Wisconsin. His practice is focused on real estate, on business, on personal injury. It looks at family issues, homeowner and condo associations, debt collection, a whole lot of fields. He's a licensed realtor as well. And just a reminder, our talk today is intended as general information, shouldn't be relied on or construed as legal advice. So maybe you can give us some advice you're thinking about for someone who's moving into a condo. What are the good things about your HOA, and maybe what are the bad? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. John Scott, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. I appreciate it. It's a great honor to be here.
How'd you get started in real estate law?
So it's funny. In law school, you know, I didn't grow up in a community association. So I didn't really know that there was an HOA or condo kind of, you know, legal side of the, you know, profession out there. So after law school, I, you know, started, you know, my first, you know, first career job, doing a little bit of debt collection, but then found myself in kind of that niche area that is the, you know, community associations. I had two great bosses and great mentors for that in Missouri. You know, I'm from Missouri. I went to undergrad in Chicago, came back to St. Louis for law school. And then 2023, I moved up to Milwaukee with my girlfriend, who's recently my fiance. So I kind of found my way into community association law. I've been practicing that for the majority of the time I've been licensed as an attorney.
And you also have a realtor license. Why'd you decide to get into that side of it?
So real estate is just interesting to me. You know, property law is the foundation of, you know, our society here in America. Life, liberty, and property, that bring it back to the civics, which is very enjoyable. And so I just really enjoy kind of all the facets that real estate has to offer. And it's cool because there are so many issues within, you know, property law. Pretty much everything you think about is property, whether it's land, a condo you own up in the air, or just, you know, your laptop that's sitting in front of me. So everything kind of relates back to property law. And because of that, it's just very interesting for me. And so I found that, you know, go one step further, you know, get my real estate license so I can truly be an effective advocate for my clients in all areas of real estate. It's helpful to know the legal side, but also just the practical side, the boots on the ground side.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. Well, let's say you're thinking about buying a condo, or anybody is. What do you need to know about the ins and outs of condo ownership?
Well, fortunately, in Wisconsin and many other states, we have, you know, laws regulating condominiums. HOAs are a little bit different because you don't have that, you know, you're sharing walls and boundaries with other people. So because in the typical sense of the condominium, you are sharing walls and boundaries with other people, that needs to be regulated in some sense. And so we have statutes, and those statutes regulate what an association's duties are. What are the homeowner's duties? And one of those, and for anybody that's bought or sold a condo, they're normally using the WB-14 condominium offer to purchase. That will kind of, you know, that states and, you know, codifies what's in the statutes. And one of those is the, you know, disclosure of certain documents. With any community association, you have governing documents. You have your articles of incorporation. You have your declaration, which is the big part. It's the thing that most people think about. You have your bylaws, which is kind of the organizational structure. And then you have rules and regulations, you know, pool times, quiet hours, things like that. And so when you're purchasing a condo, you have a statutory right. The WB-14 says within 10 days of accepting an offer, the seller has to provide you all of those documents that tell you how the association is running. What are the ins and outs, the nuts and bolts? Are they adequately funding their reserve accounts? What are the major projects? And so you're entitled to all of that information up front. And then once you receive that information, you have a statutory right within 5 days to just say, you know, I either want to complete this purchase or I don't. You don't really have to have a reason. You can say, well, I don't like, you know, what's in the budget. I don't think they're budgeting enough for this or that. And so I see some problems maybe in the future, and I don't want, you know, a special assessment to, you know, come on and I have to pay so much in the future. And so because you can have those disclosure requirements and you can you know, get out of that contract without liability, it's very important to get all those documents first. Get all the documents, view how the association is run, then maybe go, you know, tour the property, talk to as many people around there, see if it's a good fit for you, and really do your due diligence. That's the name of the game with, you know, property ownership, especially within the community association context. Do your due diligence up front so that you don't have a problem and you don't have to call a lawyer, you know, in a year or two.
Mary in Door County has a question. I think it kind of relates to what we're talking about here. So let's go there. Mary, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. It's not my issue, but I know somebody who is in a condo where the association president and treasurer don't have the financials to give out to people. Or they won't. So what do you do?
Well, financial information, I think, wouldn't that? Well, go ahead, John. It seems to me that would be something that should be available to somebody who owns or is considering a property or who is already a member of that property.
You're exactly right, Larry. Within the statutes, there is a statute that you can make a request for those documents, and the association has to honor that within a certain period of time, or else they have some liability on their hands. So you can always make a formal written request, make sure it's documented, you know, follow the statute, and, you know, make the request for whatever documents that you need. If they aren't complying with that, or if they don't keep the records, you know, that's going to be a problem that you need to address at some point. And this is why, you know, I always relate it back to get involved. The more the residents are involved, the more that they can see the transparency within the organization. I always encourage boards as well to be transparent with the residents. And so if you're ever in that situation, first make the request, make sure it's documented. If they don't honor the request, then you might need to contact a lawyer.
Is this something that, now that I'm thinking, a registered letter, or, you know, does it have to go that far?
Yeah, so it's always a good idea to send it certified, just because you get that tracking number, you can see it's delivered. So it's always good to, like you said, document every part of, you know, the record. Make sure that if you send an email, if you send a letter, make sure it's all documented somewhere and safe so that you can have that record just in case the association isn't doing what they're supposed to do under statute.
What are the most typically common legal issues you see from condos and HOAs?
One of the two, so there's two big ones. Insurance, as we all know, is rising, and it's no different, no exception for condominiums and HOAs, but condominiums in particular. In 2021, I believe we all remember these tragedy in Florida, the Surfside condo accident, where it was, I think, 12 stories that just collapsed. I think almost 100 people died. Tragedy. What we found out after that was that the board was not maintaining adequate insurance. They were not maintaining adequate maintenance records. They were not having the building, you know, inspected adequately over, you know, 5, 10, 15 year studies. So that kind of, you know, went towards why all of this happened. And then we saw a, you know, $1 billion settlement come out of that. And so insurance is a big one, because we have, I have some clients like this now that, you know, they only have a few buildings, or maybe one building as a whole, but their insurance premiums are doubling or tripling, sometimes quadrupling overnight. And so that's going to be a problem, because statute says that the association shall maintain insurance. But if it's getting so high, what do you do? There are some creative ways to go about that, you know, looking at the full replacement value. What does that mean? But insurance is a big issue, and there's really no real answer for that. You just kind of have to work with your insurance adjusters, you know, shop around, see what you can find. Maybe it's worth getting a higher deductible if your association hasn't had too many claims in the past. So insurance is a big one. And then in Wisconsin, especially, the right to rent. Many people purchase a condo with just the expectation that they're going to be able to rent this. So we have a lot of snowbirds in Wisconsin who go down south for the winter. A lot of times I've seen that they purchase a condominium expecting to rent that condominium out when they're gone to Florida for the south, for the winter. However, because of a court case, Apple Valley Hut versus McCutta, in Wisconsin, a board of directors has a unilateral right to impose rental restrictions, basically saying you're not allowed to rent your condo that you own. Sorry. Whereas in many other states, that's something that has to be in the declaration itself, which takes a whole majority of the unit owners to vote on. But in Wisconsin, it's a little bit different. The case law has allowed a board of directors to unilaterally impose those restrictions, which has made a lot of people upset. And so this goes back to the due diligence. Make sure you know that you can rent your condo out when you're purchasing it. Because we're seeing a lot of situations where people didn't realize that. They're calling an attorney, and then I have to give them the bad news that, sorry, you bought a condo and you can't rent it out.
Our guest today, John Scott, attorney based in Brookfield, and talking with him about legal issues relating to condos and HOAs, and just learning more about how they're typically structured. And you can join in. Maybe you've got an issue to share with us, or maybe some experience of your own to share. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along as we talk about condos and HOAs on the program now. We'll be doing that for the next 45 minutes or so with our guest, John Scott, attorney based in Brookfield. It's great to have John with us. And again, join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Peter in Oshkosh emailed us. Do children in condos have the same rights as adults under the Fair Housing Act? If adults can bring guests to the pool, can the board block a child from bringing an adult babysitter? Does the FHA prohibit this kind of rule?
So with children being under 18, the board can impose restrictions. So they can impose restrictions of you can't be at the pool alone if you're under 18. For the most part, we still treat, adolescents as, under 18 as not really residents. They're more, the children of the residents. So the board can impose restrictions on that. They're not, as tightly regulated as, a normal adult.
So typically you wouldn't think that if there was a child with an adult babysitter, if the child couldn't be at the pool during a time when the child could be at the pool without an adult there, you'd think that.
So that would also go to the rules and regulations. Maybe the association knows that there are a lot of children, i.e. there's going to be a lot of babysitters, and going to the pool is a fun activity. So maybe they write that into the rules and regulations, saying that as long as somebody with a fob that, checks into the check-in sign-in sheet and dictates where they're coming from, which unit they're coming from, that would be something that's dictated by the rules. So when you get kind of into those situations, you're really going to look towards what is the kind of culture of the association itself. Are there a lot of children? Are there just more adults that don't really want to see children around as much? Obviously, you can impose curfew restrictions, say that the pool or the clubhouse is closed to minors at 8 o'clock p.m. type of thing. So you can get at what your intent is by normally just kind of putting in some rules and regulations.
Mark emailed us, curious about the first right of refusal in HOA's sales of condo units.
Yes, so I think this gets the conversion statute in Chapter 703. If the condominium is being converted from apartments to condominiums, the developer, they need to give a notice to all the tenants in the building saying that you have a right of first refusal. And this is 60 days. Once you get that notice in your hand from the developer or the converter, you have 60 days to write back to them saying, I do want to purchase this. And then the statute dictates what that price may be. Or if you don't do anything, then you kind of lose that right of first refusal. Then within that statute, if you do not purchase that condo, if you don't exercise that right, then you have another 60 days before the declarant can ask you to vacate that unit. So you have a little bit of time, or it goes to the end of your lease, because obviously contract law will prevail. So you have a little bit of time once you get that notice letter, and then that's really when you need to start thinking about what's your situation. Do you want to purchase this unit? But there are rights reserved for the tenant to at least be there for a certain amount of time, even if you don't want to purchase the unit.
Jerry emailed us, their condo has a no pet policy, and their daughter and family are visiting in the area in July. They have an emotional support small dog. They have necessary documentation and so forth about it being an emotional support dog. They're not staying here the whole time, but visiting from time to time. Can they bring the dog for short visits?
So for that, we're going to obviously want to check the statutes. We're going to want to check the governing documents of the association itself. But if it truly is an emotional support animal that does have some kind of documented ability to help you, then that should be okay. However, you're going to want to disclose that to the association, whether it's the manager or whoever you correspond with. You want to disclose that. You want to let them know because you don't just want to bring the pet there and then somebody, you know, not see with the orange vest on or whatever the pet may be wearing, if they do wear something, if you don't tell anybody, then it's going to cause some problems. So disclose.
Makes good sense to me. I was kind of surprised to see that there are a number of models available for condo ownership. What are some of them? Freehold condos. I think one's called leased condos. Could you talk about the different models?
Yes. So freehold condominiums are pretty much the norm. It's what we think about. It's the association owns the land underneath it, and then you own your own individual condo. With a leasehold, somebody else may actually own that land, then you own your space in the sky. It's a little wonky to think about. It's more theoretical, but it does exist, but it's not that prevalent. And so we normally think of condominiums in the capacity as a freehold, in that the association owns everything that is in that declaration. There's also co-ops. Those are another form of ownership, and those are fairly prevalent in the bigger cities like New York, Chicago, LA, but we do find them in Milwaukee and some of the surrounding cities in Wisconsin. They aren't as prevalent, but they are different forms of ownership. A co-op is more of a corporation. You think of it as you're purchasing a share in a corporation instead of your individual unit. And because you're purchasing a share, that entitles you to live in a unit, but you're not actually, getting that unit in your name, meaning you can't mortgage that unit. So when you're purchasing a condo, you can get your typical 30-year mortgage. But if you're buying into a co-op, you've got to remember you're purchasing a share, not an actual physical space. And so because of that, you're not going to get your 30-year mortgage. But there are some trade-offs, like less closing costs, maintenance fees, depending on how active the residents are in cleaning up their own spaces. Those might be less, taxes and things like that. So there are many different pros and cons to different types of ownership. But in most states, we see, typical freehold, you own your unit, you own that space in the air, and you can, use it as you please.
So just to take another minute on the co-op situation, say there you're in this co-op for 10 years and you've lived in this place and now you need to move or want to move. So you're selling, you've invested a couple hundred thousand or 300,000 or whatever it is. So then you sell a share or?
It's a little kind of wonky to think about because most of us don't think about co-ops that much. And you're not really going to walk down the street and see an advertisement for a co-op. You kind of have to know somebody or know exactly what you're getting into. And so with condos, if you're purchasing a condo with another person, unless there's some situation which the board has the right to, say, no, I don't want that person to buy that, you can't really say no to a condo purchaser. But a board for a co-op, they can easily say, we don't really like you that much or don't think you fit in the culture, or we just want to, extend this time to buy. It's peak summer month. We want to see if somebody gives us a higher offer for, the share. And so there you can be turned down for a condominium. And so essentially you're just buying a share in a corporation. Then it's, you know, that lends itself to much more community aspect culture. But there are some pros and cons and trade-offs with that. So it's very much like I'm, you know, buying a share in the stock market, but you're buying a share in an association that allows you to live in a unit.
Okay. Maxine in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Maxine.
Hi, Larry. I live in a condo on the west side of Madison. It was built in about 1984. The PUD that was approved at that time has expired. 16 units in 4 three-story buildings were not built at that time. Now we have a new developer who wants to build 3 duplexes. That's 6 units. Our condo docs say that 75% of the existing owners have to approve the new development. Can you tell me if that's true? And if so, do we need to get an attorney to look at the docs? And how soon should we do that?
That's a great question. It's very in-depth. So that's definitely something that you should contact an attorney. Obviously, associations can even be different based in the communities that they are. So I would recommend reaching out to a condo or HOA attorney in Madison to see what they say. But yes, the statutes do dictate that. If a developer is assuming that they're going to build onto that condominium at some point, normally they have to kind of put that in the declaration at the outset that says, we have this one parcel of land that we're developing into a condo, but in the future, we may want to develop these other parcels. They kind of have to outline that at the outset. Now, because it's a new developer coming in who purchased it, it may be a little bit different. So that's going to be a very, you know, fact-specific case, and it's going to involve legal counsel and just negotiations with the developer to see what's going on. You know, take a look at the voting requirements, and if it does say that, then you know, one side may have more support than the other, but it's definitely going to be fact specific.
And so how does Maxine or anybody else, well, in her case, how would she find a proper attorney for this?
Word of mouth is a good one. Obviously, Google, you know, the internet search capabilities are great, because most condominium HOA and association law is such a niche area. You're not going to find too many people who actually practice it for a living or make, you know, most of their practice based on association law. So it is, you know, fortunately, it's a little bit easier to find somebody who practices solely in association law, because they're going to advertise it all over their website.
Maxine, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Frank sent an email. Are timeshare properties typically covered by HOAs? And are these agreements often similar to condo HOAs?
So timeshares are, we do know they are in the statutes. You know, there's the ability for them to exist, but they are different because you're not actually buying the land. You're buying, you know, similar to a co-op, you're buying kind of a time share. That's why we call them the time shares. You're sharing just a piece of time throughout the year that you can go live in there. So within that context, and many times time shares are under the, you know, guise of an association. They're in a condo, but they're just labeled as timeshares, and they're more marketed as timeshare properties. So if it is truly in an association, then that association will have its own declaration, its own bylaws, and its own rules and regulations. And so when you're purchasing a timeshare, it's important to get all of those documents as well, just to understand what your rights and responsibilities are for that, you know, 2 or 3 weeks that you're living there. But it's not really the same as owning a condo outright.
So do like Vrbo's and those kinds of, you know, that sort of operation, are they involved in any of this in any way?
Yes. So Vrbo, Airbnb, a lot of those people who list their properties, they're the outright owners of that property. You have to be to sign up on that website. You have to show and prove ownership. Absolutely, those documents are going to, or those timeshares, those properties, Airbnbs, are going to be covered under the declaration. So it's going to be very important for the person marketing their property as an Airbnb to make sure that they're going to, you know, get a good you know, visitor who's going to adhere to all the rules and regulations, you know, slap down a copy of the rules and say, this is what you can and can't do. You know, if you violate that, then you're never, you know, welcome back to my property. So it's very important if you're a condo owner that's marketing your property as an Airbnb to make sure that you get a, you know, a good visitor.
Our guest today, John Scott, attorney based in Brookfield. It's great to have him with us, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. Looking forward to talking with him. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on our station, and then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at legal issues relating to condos and homeowners associations with our guest, John Scott, today. John is an attorney based in Brookfield. Great to have him along. And questions or comments, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Larry in Portage next. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So here's my question. I live in an area that has four condo associations. The association that I live in several years ago bought the marina on a lake associated with our association. And when I bought the property, it was advertised as having deeded access to that marina. After I researched it a bit more, after I bought the property, I found out that not only did I not have deeded access, but none of the people in the association that bought the marina had deeded access. Subsequently, all of the other associations could buy into it, and when they buy into it, they received a deeded access. Is there anything I should be concerned about not having deeded access?
That's a good question. So it sounds like these four condominiums were consolidated under a master association. And so when we get to boat slips, that's a little bit different area. Sometimes we'll actually see, you know, the dock part of it, its own separate association with its own, you know, declaration, own bylaws and rules. It's kind of funny to see, but sometimes it'll be treated as its own association. So that does make sense that, you know, they would limit the right of access to that, and you would have to, you know, pay some kind of premium or entrance fee to get access to that. However, if it was marketed as you did have access, I think there's a legal issue in and of itself that you should probably contact an attorney for. You know, if it was marketed as you could access it, but then you couldn't, you know, maybe that's something to discuss with an attorney. And, you know, based on what the seller representations were to you or whoever represented that to you, that seems like a separate legal issue. But when it comes to boat slips, absolutely, an association can and often does charge additional fees to have that. Sometimes you'll get just plain access to it, and, you know, if it's just a ramp that you can put your boat into. But sometimes if there are slips, you can actually pay to have your own slip, similar to just having your own condo. You have your own slip. So it's very you know, regulated by each association, however they want to do it. But if it's something that's of concern and you think that all owners should have, you know, access to it, then that's something I would encourage you to go to the board meetings, participate in, you know, the governance of the association, make your voice heard. Because if you're thinking this, chances are there's probably other residents who are wanting access as well.
Makes sense. Larry, thanks for calling. Karen emailed us, their condos have shared outdoor space. What are some solutions for allowing people to develop lovely gardens around their condo, but then the next owner doesn't want to maintain that garden? The association now has legal responsibility for everything beyond 5 feet of foundations, but many garden beyond that.
Interesting. Yeah. So I think, Larry, your viewers might get a little mad with me because every answer I'm going to say is going to be, it's going to be dependent on the governing documents. So I would take a look at what those say, what the rights and responsibilities of each owner are. But yes, gardening, you know, taking care of your own space, it's absolutely a concern for most people. And that's what, you know, with a condominium association, with any association, you have what's called common area and limited common elements. Common area is what we all think about, you know, your pool, your clubhouse, anywhere that all the residents are able to go freely, you know, and use as their own will. But if something is exclusive to your use, let's say, you know, a porch or a deck that's only for your condo, that's something that's called a limited common element. It is a common element, but it's limited to your exclusive use. And so that may be one way to get around this, is discuss with the association at the board meetings and all the other residents, and maybe, you know, figure out if you can rewrite the declaration, the rules, the bylaws, or if it's already kind of in there, you just need to have a different interpretation of it. You know, put your area as a limited common element so that your neighbors don't have to interfere with it. They don't have to maintain it. They don't have to do anything with it. If it's yours for your exclusive use, that should probably be a limited common element that, you know, you take care of your own garden.
Jacob emailed, he lives in a condo with a shared wall and is often awakened by his neighbor who works the third shift. What resource does he have to limit the noise?
And so that, you know, that problem alone is why we kind of had to codify, you know, the rights and remedies and obligations that owners have under condominiums, because you do share these shared walls. Normally in rules and regulations, sometimes it's even in the declaration, you're going to have nuisance provisions. It's, you know, obviously you got to be quiet during certain hours. You can't make ruckuses. Don't, you know, do anything to make the police called on you. So if it truly is out of the ordinary, if they're coming home and banging everything, and if it's, you know, truly seems like it's not something that a normal person, quote unquote, would do when they come home from work, then maybe you get the association involved. I would first, you know, talk to the neighbor, try to work it out amicably, see if there's something that, you know, you guys can agree to. But if not, maybe the nuisance provisions and the rules and regulations, they might come into play.
I was thinking about some friends who bought a condo in a brand new unit.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of in a more upscale, and there were some within the maintenance or within the there were some noise rules put in that the builder guaranteed that they would be quiet to a certain level, and they weren't when they moved in, and so the. Actually, in that case, went back to court on it, I think, or at least back to the builder, and the builder had to do some extensive work to fix it, fix the sound issues, and they were fixed, and it had to have been expensive on the part of the builder.
Oh, of course, and that's interesting. I've never really heard a developer. You know, say what their decibel level will be. So that's I'd be interested to learn more about that, because that's a little bit interesting.
Yeah.
And you bring up a good topic with that. You know, a lot of this, the nuisance, the noise area, comes under, you know, pets. You know, a lot of people, they don't want to hear, you know, big dogs above them, you know, stomping around all day. And so many people think that, oh, we got to have a rule about pets and limit the size of pets, and only, you know, certain dogs under a certain weight can be there. But as we all know, you know, some smaller dogs can make more of a ruckus than the large dogs. And so with all within the context of, you know, being annoyed by your neighbor, normally this can be taken care of with the rules and regulations for noise, nuisance, and complaints like that. So I would encourage the residents to look to their governing documents to see if it already kind of outlines the remedies and procedures they should take if they have an issue like this.
I've looked at condos just out of interest, you know, general interest, and I always want to look at the fees that they charge, and sometimes the fees seem to be pretty large, at least in my own estimation. What do HOA fees typically cover?
So, yeah, these are called assessments. And, you know, sometimes associations will make you pay, you know, all of your year's assessments up front. Some, you know, if it's an HOA, a typical subdivision where they don't have too many maintenance responsibilities, you know, you're not covering insurance for an entire building that everybody's living under. Normally, the costs are a little bit lower, you know, unless you have, you know, a big management company that charges excessive fees, or if you have a pool that needs to be maintained frequently. Normally, HOAs will be a little bit less in assessments than condos, just because of the maintenance responsibilities are more put on the owners themselves. Whereas in a condo, you're going to hire maintenance crews, you're going to hire management companies, you're going to hire all of these services that cost money. And so I've got a friend down in Missouri, his HOA dues are $100, I think, a year. Something like crazy like that. But I've also, in the same context, I'll pick up the phone and I'll get a call from a condo owner that says, my fees are already $1,000 a month, and now they want to raise them to $1,500. And so we have to dig into why is that. And going back to my earlier statement about insurance and maintenance and management contracts, those are really going to be the drivers, because most of the time the boards of directors aren't going to get paid a salary, or if they do, it's going to be nominal. So the real drivers of assessment is the maintenance of all the common areas, the insurance that you've got to pay, and things surrounding that.
Dennis in Madison emailed, can a board mandate a special assessment without owners voting on it? For example, the roof is leaking. And what happens if you can't get enough people to run for the board of directors? That's another issue. And finally, does the state offer any programs to help with condo insurance for condos?
So it's a
three parts here. Yeah. Can a board mandate a special assessment without an owner voting on it?
So that's what we're seeing a lot. And normally it's going to take owner vote to do that. And there, within the statutes, there are requirements for calling special meetings and voting on things like this. So, but that's one of the issues of, you know, why you need to do your due diligence up front is understand if the board is collecting adequate assessments, if they're adequately saving in their reserve accounts for rainy days like this, where, you know you're going to get a need to replace the roof every, 20, 30 years. So you should start thinking about that early on. And so the board is going to take this. They're going to see that, okay, maybe we don't have adequate reserves. And so they're going to need to call a special assessment, a special meeting for that special assessment, and get a vote on it. And that's something that, I encourage you to work with an attorney to see if those, are doable, if you need to kind of make any arguments for or against those special assessments. So it's really going to be a case-by-case basis with special assessments. But unfortunately, they are a reality.
Well, and the second part was, what happens if you can't get enough people to run for the board of directors?
And that is a big headache in the HOA and condo world is, we want participation. We need participation. Without participation in your association, you can't get anything done. You can't make the major decisions. So sometimes it can be very hard. That is just, it's more of a, boots on the ground, grassroots campaign, knock on your neighbor's doors, go to the meetings, figure out, is there somebody that, may not necessarily want to be a board member, but they have the level of expertise that would, help the association. So that's really going to be a get all of your residents together and try to think of a solution. Something along the lines of that. Let's say there is a board that's operating, but they don't get enough people to come to the meetings to vote on things. This is a very real problem that we're seeing as well. With any kind of meeting, and if you're going to vote on anything, you have to have a quorum. You have to have a certain number of people just attend the meeting to be able to vote. Oftentimes, we don't see enough people even come to the meetings, which can be, hard on association when they're just trying to do the right thing. And if that happens, sometimes you have to initiate a lawsuit and get a court order to change whatever you need to be changed because you're not getting enough participation. And that can be very expensive, very, time costliness. So I always encourage people to participate. Go to the meeting, see what's going on in your association, because then you'll be better equipped to make your association out to what you want it to be.
And the third part was, does the state offer any programs to help with insurance for condos?
Yes, there is a Wisconsin insurance plan. They bill it as the last resort. So if you know you can't find insurance anywhere else, there is a, Wisconsin does offer programs, but the premiums are going to be high, deductibles are going to be high. It's definitely billed as a last resort. But because by statute you have the association does have to maintain insurance, there are programs out there that will help you, but it might cost you an arm and a leg.
And somebody else wonders, can an HOA force delinquent homeowners to pay up?
Yes. So both within the condominium statute, and there are only two statutes that kind of outline and regulate HOAs, because HOAs are kind of independent upon themselves and really based on the declaration, the contract between the resident and the association. Within the but state law does allow both HOAs and condominiums to collect assessments and to place a lien on your property if you don't collect those assessments. And so if you don't pay your assessments, let's say, you know, 6 months later, you're, you know, facing a debt of a few thousand dollars, the association will normally contact an attorney to place a lien on your property. And if you still don't pay, they can initiate a lawsuit and foreclose that lien, much like, you know, a bank would foreclose a mortgage if you fall behind on your mortgage payments. So the association does have real remedies that they can use and employ to get their assessments, because assessments are really the lifeblood of an association. If they're not collecting money, they can't hire, you know, the people to cut the grass. They can't hire the management companies to make sure everything's being run smoothly. So just being in an association, you should pay your assessments. And if you don't, it could get bad very quickly.
Are the directors paid at all?
So normally not. You know, a board is normally, or an association is more normally formed as a nonprofit or a non-stock corporation. But a board can be paid. Let's say it's a, you know, like the previous caller was saying, there's a master association with four different condominium associations within it. That's pretty large. And so if you're asking, you know, three or four or five people to govern an entire association, they might want some compensation for that. So that's very much, that will be in the declaration. You should know that if you're going in and buying a condo, that will be something that's disclosed to you, but it's not too common.
Sylvia in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. We're in a situation right now where we had hail damage on the roof, and supposedly somebody inspected the roofs and said we had hail damage and we needed to have the roof's replaced, and we were told, we have a manager for our association, so we were told that the insurance adjuster came and looked at it, and that it was, they had decided that it was minimal damage, and they were not going to replace the roofs. Now, here's a problem. This insurance we currently have, and I have no idea what it is, because when I asked the board member, I'm not on the board, who we had for insurance, she doesn't know the name of the insurance company, and they are no longer going to insure us come August because they're no longer insuring condos. So if somebody makes this decision not to replace these roofs, where does that leave us with getting insurance in the future?
That is a tricky situation that a lot of associations are dealing with right now is, you know, some of the major players in the insurance game are just completely dropping associations. Some are raising their premiums, you know, three or fourfold. And so when that happens, like I said, there are, you know, ways to get insurance, Wisconsin insurance plan, things like that. But it's really going to kind of need to be a creative solution with the board and the residents to figure out, what's the level of insurance that we need? Is there any way that, you know, if it's a shared building, if it's one big building with one roof, it's going to be a little bit different than if, you know, a condominium with, you know, duplexes around a cul-de-sac. But maybe there's a way to shift some of the liability from the association onto the homeowner. The association will maintain a basic liability or insurance property plan, then shift the rest of the liability onto the homeowner. And so maybe that's an avenue to go down, but it's really going to be determinative based on the association. We're going to have to take a look at all the governing documents. What does the insurance clauses say? And working with insurance adjusters and different companies just to try to find the best solution. Because like you said, it is a real big problem, and there's really no one size fits all solution with that.
Sylvia, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. What should you think about before putting your condo on the market to sell your condo? Do you need to notify your HOA of something like that?
Yes, they'll want to be involved in the decision, you know, not necessarily totally involved, but they'll want to know that ownership is changing. So like I said, disclosure. Oftentimes, the seller just won't have all of the required documents that they do need to give to a prospective buyer. And so that's when it's going to come into play. You have to ask the association for those documents. And they have statutorily, they're required within 10 days to give you those documents. So you will have to coordinate. There may be some special rules and regulations within the governing documents themselves that state the process of what an owner has to do. Because remember, the statutes, Chapter 703, are more basic. They kind of give you the skeletal structure of how an association should be run. And so within any individual association's governing documents, there may be additional rules and regulations that a seller needs to go to comply with the declaration in order to sell their unit. So it's going to take a look at the state statute and your individual governing documents.
Hmm. I'm wondering, does an HOA ever buy a property back from somebody?
We normally advise them not to, because associations are really not in the business of being landlords. They're in the business of running an association. Sometimes it has to happen because there's nobody at the foreclosure sale that wants to purchase it. So the property will just revert back to the association and they'll have to figure out what to do with it. But because associations really aren't equipped to be landlords, I normally try to tell associations to stray away from owning an actual unit in the complex. But it does happen.
Here's off the target a little bit, but you're involved in real estate. Somebody wants to know about real estate conditions reports. They're especially related to undisclosed defects. If you're selling, talk about that for a minute or two.
Yes. Yeah, so within any typical purchase contract that we get from the Wisconsin Real Estate Examining Board, it's always going to have a contingency of getting that real estate condition report. And it's a state law that you have to disclose all of these defects. So as a seller, you're going to want to disclose everything that you can. Now, if there's mold behind the walls and that you just don't know of, then you don't know about it. But if you know that there's mold seeping up from a corner of your basement, that's something you're going to have to disclose. You can't rely on the buyer to do, to get an inspection and to uncover all these defects. If you're hiding something that is, everybody's aware of this defect when they walk into the house, that's going to come back on you. So like I said before, disclose, because if not, it could come back to bite you.
Yeah. And what happens when a buyer discovers an undisclosed defect?
So that will be written into the purchase contract, but it's also part of the contingency that if it is, if there is a defect, then the buyer is going to have a couple options. Is it enough of a defect to be able to get out of the contract, or is it something that could be easily remediated? But most of the time, you're going to put the seller on notice. You're going to say, hey, seller, I've uncovered this defect, or, my inspector did. And so we have one of two options. I still want to buy this property, but I don't want to buy it in this condition. So, let's go back to the negotiation table. Maybe the seller will pay for the repairs, and we'll just, put it as a credit on the ultimate sale price. So if you do uncover a defect, but you're still very intent on buying the property, there's many things you can do to try to remediate that. And if, a seller is motivated, they'll work with you.
Yeah, you would hope. And you want to make sure if you know about something, it should be in that condition report.
Correct. And it's a pretty easy checklist. It's a 4 or 5 pages. You go down, you check yes, no, unsure. If you know of something, you can write in a little explanation. It's very easy. The homeowner has to do it. They have to fill it out for any property that's 1 to 4 units. So just, do it, be honest. And, that should be good.
John, here we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I've learned a lot myself, and I know our listeners have as well. So thank you so much for taking your time. I hope we can do it again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. I'm truly honored to be on here and happy to come back anytime.
John Scott, attorney based in Brookfield. He practices on a whole bunch of things, real estate, business, personal property, personal injury, homeowner and condo associations, of course, debt collection, other related fields, and he is a licensed realtor as well. So good to have somebody with that kind of background as a realtor, for sure. Coming up, we're going to take a look at fireworks, among other things, with our next guest, Bassam Shakashiri. I'm Larry Mueller. Okay, a little fireworks music to get us going here. I'm sure I'm not alone in seeing some great fireworks displays and wondering how in the heck do they do that. And we're going to find that out today, among other things. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. And our guest, Bassam Shakashiri, back with us, an emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, a national proponent for science and education. And he's going to talk with us about how scientists make those 4th of July oohs and ahs possible. And he's happy to share his enthusiasm and knowledge of science with us today. So, are you curious about science? How do you learn more about science in everyday life? Bassam could answer your questions, and I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Bassam, great to have you back.
Thank you so much, Larry, for having me. I'm always looking forward to being with you and your fabulous audience. I hear from so many of them, and they all are very complimentary, at least the ones I hear from.
Okay, good. Well, let's look at fireworks there to start out. What are the most common ingredients that you find inside a firework?
Well, Independence Day is coming up, and I want to say a few things about that, too, but we celebrate by setting off fireworks. Fireworks generate very noticeable forms of energy, a tremendous release of sound, that's what we hear, bright light that we enjoy, and heat. We don't feel the heat because we are far away. We should be far away from where the fireworks are set off. The tremendous booms that we hear at ground level are the result of the very rapid release of energy into the air, causing the air to expand faster than the speed of sound. And that's what produces a shockwave and a sonic boom. So you asked me about what's in them, so I'm trying to describe what the phenomena are, and then I'll get to that. The colors are produced by heating metal salts. So one of the ingredients is having metallic salts, such as sodium chloride or sodium nitrate and others. These salts emit very characteristic colors. The atoms in each of these elements absorb energy and release it as light of specific colors. So the selection of the salt is important to produce the color that we like to see. I'll just add the energy of the atom rearranges the electrons from a low energy state to a higher energy state. But when the excess energy of the high energy state is emitted as light, that's what we see it, and that's what we see. So there are binders that are added to the salts, and there's a fuse, of course, and the fuse has to be carefully constructed and designed so that there's no premature setting off of the firework. You want it to get up in the air, so it has to be propelled up in the air. It's really a science. It started as an art. The Chinese were very good at it a long time ago, and others are very good at it. The characteristic colors that we enjoy, red, for example, that's because strontium salts or lithium salts are added. The orange color that we see is from calcium. The silver color that we see is from burning aluminum or titanium, sometimes magnesium. The blue color is from copper salts, copper chloride. The beautiful green that cascades down, they all cascade down. The green comes from barium salts. So the composition, the relative amounts of the chemicals that are added in there, along with the proper propulsion that is needed, is crucial to the construction of the fireworks. So that I have a lot more about your question and about so many other aspects of fireworks on my website, and I would like to invite everyone to visit my website, scifun, scifun.org. And you can see on the homepage an entry that says, guess what it says, Larry? Fireworks. Fireworks. And there is a description. It's about 2 pages long, a little over 2 pages long, with all kinds of fascinating, interesting details. But I also want to emphasize safety. Yeah. I think fireworks should be set off by people who are professionals, and they should be set off far away from people, and of course from animals. You know, animals react to the sound. They're fearful of it, especially dogs. So we need to always be obeying the safety rules as we celebrate holidays, Independence Day, and other occasions where we set off fireworks. But we should do that safely, and to try to succeed, not only try to succeed and not causing any injury. And so, Larry?
Yeah.
May I just say something about very important to me about fireworks? We set them off to celebrate Independence Day, and all of us should think about what Independence Day really means. In America, it is on the 4th of July. We call it the 4th of July, but you know, there's a 4th of July in every country around the world. So Independence Day, to me, is the time to affirm and to reflect on who we are, what we stand for, and what we want to continue to be. And I suggest very earnestly and respectfully for others to read what I read beginning in May. I start reading 3 documents. The first one is the Declaration of Independence. The second one is the U.S. Constitution. And the third one is the Bill of Rights. I know the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, but it's set aside. These 3 documents are crucial to our identity as a society, to our well-being as we get along, as we should try to get along well with each other, and remembering the great heritage that we have that got us to where we are. Yes, let's celebrate. Let's enjoy fireworks. Let's gather friends and families, and let's have cookouts. Let's enjoy the outdoors. But my plea to my fellow citizens is to mark Independence Day and to think deeply about the issues that are reflected in the Declaration of Independence, in the U.S. Constitution, and in the Bill of Rights.
But Sam Shakashiri, our guest today, and we talked about the Constitution earlier on the show today with a guest who teaches a class in La Crosse on civics and civic responsibility, and part of it is the study of the Constitution. But we'll get to that a little bit more, but I know we've got Brooklyn in Madison has a comment relating to fireworks. Brooklyn, go ahead.
Well, I just had a question on exactly how they work and how they can become so beautiful.
Yeah, you know, you see these kind of shooting stars go up, and then you also see a lot of times designs. There may be a firework that goes off that looks like Abraham Lincoln's face, or it might be a whirling circle, or it could be a lot of things. And I'm with Brooklyn on this a little bit, but Sam, how do they organize that within a firework to make it work?
They organize it very artistically and very carefully, and they try to produce the images that appear up in the sky and that appeal to our senses. The joy of seeing the different images, whether it's a circle or a facsimile of President Lincoln, or just a shooting set of stars falling down and then exploding. All of this is designed carefully by professionals. And it is really a magnificent show to witness and to understand the chemistry and the science that relates to all this. Now, I am very careful, Larry, and everyone in the listening audience, not to mention any recipes for making fireworks. Because safety is paramount in everything that I do and everything that I say. And the fireworks are to be prepared by professionals and set off by professionals. So I've said this already, but I want to repeat it again.
That makes good sense. Brooklyn, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. But Sam Shakashiri, our guest, join in with your own thoughts. I'm Larry Mueller. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, as we talk with him about science. We're talking the science relating to fireworks, but also talking a little bit as well about science itself as we approach July 4th and our Independence Day. I know Bassam's already had a few words about that. Probably we'll have some more words about that as well as we move along today. And again, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Bert emailed us, how much toxins are released into the air from fireworks?
Very good questions. All the questions that your audience asks are very good. Yes, they produce some toxins, and that's why we need to be far away from them. And when they fall, the aftermath of fireworks produces remaining chemicals that are not friendly to human life, to plant life, and to animal life. So we should be careful where they are set off. And the organizers of fireworks, you know, they keep that in mind most of the time. You know, the smoke is produced, the particle size of what the smoke ingredients affect our lungs, depending on what that size is. So it's important to always enjoy fireworks from a distance.
Yeah. Dick in Brooklyn has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, my question would be, how do we dispel the mistrust that I see? People seem to, it seems to be a phenomenon that's expanding, and people don't understand that science isn't always absolute, that it evolves, but there's a tremendous amount of mistrust out there right now, and I find that very troubling.
Yeah, Dick, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Bassam.
I share your feelings. Thank you for bringing this up. Let me just stay at the outset. The current state of science and technology in America is as good as it has ever been. The quality of life that we have in America and around the world is the result of making new discoveries and putting those discoveries to good use. And all of that is based on trust, on understanding, and providing support for scientists and science communicators to do their work. So let me also say, Larry and everyone else, the generosity of the American people has been put to good use in chemistry, in physics, biology, engineering, all the neurosciences, medical sciences. We have new pharmaceuticals. I can go on and on. It is important for all of us to share the values of the high-quality research that goes on. And we share it if we understand it. If we don't understand it, we should ask about it. But in addition to sharing it, if the proposed cuts in the federal budget in support of the National Science Foundation or NASA or the National Institutes of Health or NOAA or FEMA, if those cuts are put into law, and they are before the Congress now, before the Senate especially, if that's going to cause, let me put it straight, irreparable damage to our society, irreparable damage to the aspirations of young people who are curious, wanting to pursue scientific research, wanting to benefit from these discoveries that are made. So it's very, very crucial that we converse with each other respectfully. Name-calling is not going to help us get out of the mess that we're in now. It's crucial that we converse and urge our elected officials in the Senate and in the House in Washington now, tomorrow, before Independence Day, to see to it that proper federal support continues to come to science, to all of education, and also, Larry, to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, of which WPR and PBS Wisconsin are beneficiaries. But the true beneficiaries are the audiences that we have. And it's incumbent upon us to truly urge our elected officials to act responsibly for the well-being of society. So thank you for asking this question.
Thanks, Dick. Appreciate the call. And we'll take some other calls. We have some more calls that relate to fireworks. And let's go to Rick in St. Germain next. Rick, hello.
Hey. Yeah. I was just wondering that a lot of these cities around here on 4th of July are shooting their fireworks out over a lake. And is that kind of environmentally not good for the lake, or how does that work?
Yeah.
It's an action that's unfriendly to the lake because the fallout ends up in the lake and contaminates the lake. We need to really be careful where these fireworks are set off. Even if they fall down on soil, they contaminate the soil too. But these ingredients that remain after the fireworks are set off and they fall in water. They dissolve in the water, and depending on the amounts, they are toxic. So yes, we should learn from what science tells us. We should question what science tells us, but we should also learn from it, and we should establish and follow safe procedures for celebrations, including setting off fireworks. But we should be extremely responsible for the environment in which we are living and for the environment in which these fireworks are set off.
Yeah. Rich, thank you for calling. Shyla in Mississippi, your turn. Hi, Shyla.
Hi. I just had a question about, like, the history behind fireworks.
Yeah. So you mentioned kind of in passing, I think, at the beginning, Bassam, but what's kind of the history behind fireworks?
Oh, they're very old history. Over 1,000 years, maybe 2,000 years, people discovered that certain chemicals, when mixed together, produce light and sound. And then they also discovered the Chinese are the history of the Chinese fireworks is well understood. And I have a little bit of that on my website, you know, scifun.org, scifun.org, relates to how the evolution of fireworks has taken place over the past 500,000 to 2,000 years. It is really a tribute to human ingenuity that fireworks are still around and are, for the most part, not entirely, for the most part, used safely. I keep emphasizing safety, Larry, and Shyla, everyone else listening. We need to be fully aware of the consequences of what we are doing so that we don't cause any injury to ourselves, to animals, to the entire planet.
Shyla, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood City, your turn. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I absolutely love science. I've always been curious, though, why they refer to time as half-life.
During science experiments, oh.
I'm sorry. She's asking about the term
why do scientists refer to time as half-life during science experiments?
Oh, half-life is a measure of the time it takes for half the amount you start with to disappear or to be consumed. So it's a term. It's for example in radioactive material, the half-life is the length of time. It could be in seconds, microseconds, minutes, years, hundreds of years. The length of time it takes for half the amount that you start with to disintegrate, to disappear, to be consumed. That's what half-life is.
And they refer to it that way to give people an idea of how long something's going to stick around.
Yes, and if it is a radioactive substance that's emitting dangerous radiation, that also is a telltale of how long it should be, how long we should be avoiding it or be able to contain it, how to contain it.
Yeah, there you go, Christina. Thank you. And finally, a sparkler. It's a handheld firework. I guess it burns slower. What are sparklers made of?
That similar to what we have in the in the fireworks. And I have a special entry on my website about the sparklers. So take a look at it. But please, I guess for the fifth or sixth time, handle everything. It sets off heat, fire, handle it safely. Sparklers are wonderful to look at. If you're holding one, keep it away from your face and especially away from other people. So they have the similar ingredients to what I just talked about before, but they don't produce different colors. Well, some of them produce different colors depending on what they have been, how they were made, what we put in them. Yeah, yeah. So by all means, visit SciFun, SCIFUN.org, and on the homepage, under the big entry called Learn About, click on what, Larry?
Fireworks.
Fireworks.
But Sam, thank you so much for joining in. Appreciate it very much. We'll look forward to another visit.
Thank you.
Sam Shakashiri, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at the UW-Madison. Always great to have him with us. And thanks for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers are Clara Neipert and Joel Patenaud. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.